Undertaker going to the top now. Again, high risk maneuver.
A Pillman move. Liger hit his head on the canvas. Flying Brian using his legs, bridging back, and he got it.
Ready to go inside the ropes like you've never been before and watch the most famous and infamous matches in wrestling history along with legends of the squared circle. Welcome to the first wrestling podcast in the world to take you on a weekly deep dive into classic matches. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Payoff. Welcome to episode number 4 of The Payoff. This is Tom Healy, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Jeffrey Ryan. Jeff, we have another awesome match this week on The Payoff. But first of all, how the hell are you doing?
Man, the day this episode goes live, I should be sitting poolside on vacation. So I'm sure not just today, but on that day, I'm just doing fantastic. So
where are you going?
A little holiday time with the family in Las Vegas, actually. And as you and I know, I have to shout out to one of our favorite places, Carmine's Italian restaurant. Free plug here from Tom and I. If you would like to send us steak and meatballs now, we would gladly accept. I'll pick them up, DoorDash, whatever. We're a fan.
You have not lived until you've split a 60-ounce porterhouse from that place along with a buddy of yours. It's that good.
Now that we got the important stuff out of the way, like trying to score free steak, every week we got a classic match lined up, and I am just pumped to talk about this one. So, of course, before we dive in, we want to say thank you to everyone for listening and subscribing. Tell your friends, tell your family, but make sure that you are subscribing and give us those 5 stars. We want to keep bringing content to you. So you can always find The Payoff on Twitter and Instagram. It's at Payoff Pod. Tom on Twitter is at Payoff Tom, and myself, Twitter, at Payoff Jeff. Simple. So Tom, I'm all good. How are you now?
All right. You got all your shit in. So, hey, the only thing I have to say is thank you, thank you, thank you. We keep growing. We're getting more people every day, really. They're listening to the show that are finding the first episode and second and third one now. And it's really exciting just stepping back and taking a deep breath and thinking about it. Everything that's happening so far has exceeded our expectations. And so we're really working hard at this. We're putting a ton of time into it. But to really step back and look at it, we're ahead of the schedule that we had for ourselves, and it's simply because of everyone listening. So thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. It allows us to have the energy to keep putting more time and effort into this so that it hopefully gets better and we keep delivering so that this is a must listen for you every single week. So we're excited about that. We're excited to launch a Patreon here soon, which will be exciting, and just good stuff happening at The Payoff. So for everyone that's new to The Payoff, Jeff, let them know how this works every Monday when we drop a new episode.
Yeah, of course. So we give you a weekly deep dive into a match every Monday. Tom and I will walk you through a few different segments. And of course, we always have a special guest superstar or legend to help us break down the match and just share some stories. So 3 parts. Part one, the build. The build is Tom and I just laying the foundation so that you have a better understanding of what got us to the point where this match happened. We want to know what was going on in the wrestling business, the stories of the competitors, whoever they might be, you know, who is the face, who is the heel, just all of that. Whether you were in the arena or each episode of The Payoff just introduces you to a new match, we want you to know the build. So part two, the payoff. The payoff is where we watch a match along with a legend or superstar of the business. We heard from Vicky Guerrero, and the reception toward her has just been incredible. Buff the Stuff, we didn't even know if he would want to talk about Judy Bagwell on a pole, but he was all about it. And of course, the legendary Magnum TA discussing his I Quit steel cage match with Tully Blanchard. We bring these people on to talk about a match, but we always get just so much more insight, and they just share some really cool stories along the way. So part three, the aftermath. What happened after the 1-2-3 and the bell rung? We break it down. You know, was this a one-off match? Maybe it was the payoff from a long build. Whatever it might have been, we give you some additional analysis. And then we try and wrap it up and give you some, maybe some reviews from the experts. We pull from a couple different places and just see what others were saying. We share our personal thoughts on the match. And then to close it out, we give you our payoff score. So Tom, what else you got?
Yeah, it's great stuff, Jeff. And again, each week we cover a match. We don't talk about the current product. We try to give you fresh and unique information. And each week we just try to have as much fun as possible with each other, with our guests. And we hope you're enjoying wherever you may be listening. So a quick recap, first three episodes, all of which are in the archives. And we'd really appreciate it if you checked them out if you haven't done so already. We had that episode number one, all-time classic, Eddie Brock, No Way Out 2004. And what an awesome guest Vicky Guerrero was. Episode number two, we had the infamous match, the Buff Bagwell versus Canyon, Judy Bagwell on a pole with WCW New Blood Rising 2000. And as Jeff said, Magnum TA, man, he was fantastic last week. That I Quit steel cage match from Starrcade 85 against Tully Blanchard. Hearing from Magnum, Jeff and I just dug up some really cool information we shared as we did the research. So check those three episodes out in the archives. That's another great way you can support the show if you haven't already listened to them. So here we are, episode number four. What we like to do each week is just explain why we chose the match. I'll give my reasons, Jeff will give his, and just to give you an idea as to why we thought this was interesting, because we're not just picking these out of a hat. And a little behind the scenes is that, you know, we've recorded quite a few matches with wrestlers. So we've got our own archive of potential episodes, and we really deliberate back and forth as to what we want to do next, how we want to pace them out over the coming months. So for me, the reason I wanted this one, first of all, it's an all-time classic. Interestingly enough, WWE came up with a list, and it was the top matches on the network. They called it, if you want to look it up, WWE Network's top 100 best matches to see before you die. This was number 34. Now you think about it, you're like, oh, that's pretty high. Well, keep in mind, that's everything on the network. That they have a ton of content. So this is a big time match. Second of all, we thought it would be really unique to watch it with Brian's son. And he's a young professional wrestler. He's doing great things in the business. So just like as watching the Eddie match with Vicky, I like the fact that you're getting a really different and interesting perspective, which is one of the things we try to do here on The Payoff. So we want to give you something new each week. We want to give you something interesting, something fresh, something that maybe you haven't heard over and over again before. Jeff, those are my thoughts. Why did you think this would be a good episode?
Yeah, I think that just what it did to change the game in regards to light heavyweights or cruisers, whatever you want to call them, it can't ever be understated. And we talked last week about just honoring wrestling's past and understanding where the origins of some of these things, where these moves came from, where the characters came from. And I think this match brought just a whole new style of wrestling to the U.S. from two incredible performers. So with that being said, let's get to the build.
That's right, the build. As always, we like to set the stage for you. This is Super Brawl 2, WCW, taking place February 29th, 1992. Now, the venue I actually found to be pretty interesting. This is the Milwaukee Theater at the Mecca, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, interestingly enough, this is now called the Miller High Life Theater, but this building's been around since 1909. It has to be one of the oldest buildings in the Midwest. It's unbelievable. And if you look closely on TV, you could see it looked old, you know, back in 1992. So the show would draw a full house of 5,000 fans. That's 4,000 paid for a total gate of 67,000. Now, a little over a month later, WWF would run WrestleMania 8. That takes place in a big dome, the Hoosier Dome in Indianapolis. That's the event where we got the double main event featuring Ric Flair in one match against Randy Savage, and then Hulk Hogan in another match against Sid. Now, Jeff, don't ever get me started on this show about why we didn't get Flair Hogan at WrestleMania 8. I will bitch about it for an hour. I'm still angry about it 30 years later.
Is this the rock you die on?
Oh, and interestingly enough, I saw Hogan Flair at my first ever house show at the Igloo in Pittsburgh a few months prior. It was when they were testing it out, I guess, to see if it should be a main event. For whatever reason, Vince McMahon didn't like it, blah, blah, blah. My point is that being the WWF guy, Hulk Hogan, big star, I didn't know Ric Flair that well. And so he was this huge star from the South, and just putting them together, I think it should have been magic. And it's hard to believe we didn't get that match. But just to set the scene, that's what was really WCW is competing against is 5 weeks or whatever it is after this Super Brawl 2, we're getting WrestleMania 8, the biggest show, biggest stage. They're doing it in a dome, which, again, they wasn't like they were doing that every year back in the day. So the height of all this, we have these two companies that are fighting. WWF's obviously doing a little bit better, but what I found interesting is we're going back and watching some of these WCW shows from this era. They were sneaky good. And I'm really looking forward to covering a lot of these matches because either I haven't seen them or it's just been years since I saw them. So just really interesting. And I'll give you an example is this card. Now, you talk about things being sneaky good. This card had some really interesting stuff going on. You had Lex Luger and Sting. That's the main event. That's for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. Now, Sting would beat Luger. The reason being, or part of it being, is that Luger was headed up north. Now, he'd be part of the World Bodybuilding Federation and then the WWF, but the point was he was signing with Vince. He was out of there. This was his final WCW match till 1995 when he returned. Just some other interesting things on this card. You had Ron Simmons versus Cactus Jack, who obviously went on to be Mankind, Mick Foley, Dude Love, whatever else he's gone by. Rick Rude versus Ricky Steamboat, which that was an awesome match. There's also a tag match. Barry Windham and Dustin Rhodes against Larry Sabisco and some young cat by the name of Steve Austin. So it's fun to look back at this show. But the reason we're here, Brian Pillman, Jushin Thunder Liger, it's the first match on this pay-per-view and obviously a hell of an opener. Now, fans were actually treated in the building to a dark match between Big Josh defeating Diamond Dallas Page. Now, Jeff, surprise me here. Tell me if you know who Big Josh is.
El Torito.
So no. I had I had no idea either. So I looked it up. I didn't know this, but it was actually Matt Bourne who would go on to become Doink. So we always try to throw a couple other little bonus nuggets in each episode of The Payoff. So
that's how you win trivia tonight. There you go.
That's right. So with that being said, give us your notes on the build. How did we get up to this match, Jeff?
Yeah, I'll first start with a little background on the one and only Jushin Thunder Liger. Liger has been around forever. He's timeless, over 35 years in the business. But I'll admit that the first time I really started following him was when he took on Tyler Breeze at NXT TakeOver Brooklyn in 2015. For our younger listeners or those that don't follow New Japan, you might be in the same boat as me, but he has spent most of his career in New Japan and has had just incredible success there and really any promotion that he's gone to. So the match with Prince Pretty was actually his first WWE match that after 30 years in the industry, he had never wrestled one. So that was his first one in WWE. So Flying Brian Pillman, he had already been in WCW for a few years, but Pillman was different than what most American audiences had seen before. His in-ring style blended a lot of different things. And so he had the high-flying, just fast maneuvers of the Lucha Libre. He took the Japanese strong style, just stiff shots and kind of how he would go after his opponents. And you can see it from even watching this match, just the technical skill that he demonstrated, just ring holds or mat holds and all these other different things, just fantastic. And so he really was the complete package and offering something that no one else was doing. So the feud with Jushin Liger started in kind of late 1991. Pillman had actually become the inaugural WCW light heavyweight champion. I won't call it hot shotting the belt, but there was some back and forth over about 4 or 5 months. Pillman actually won it first through a single elimination tournament, beating the one and only Ricky Morton, or as many of us know him, one half of the Rock and Roll Express. So that was October 91 at Halloween Havoc. But only a few weeks later, Liger actually won the belt on Christmas Day in a house show in Atlanta. And so for me, having like grown up in Detroit, I would say I would much rather go to a wrestling show on Christmas Day than watch the Detroit Lions lose every Thanksgiving. So it's just crazy to think that that type of change happened at a house show, because it's really unfathomable nowadays. But after the house show defeat, it wouldn't be long before these guys met again in February of 92 at Super Brawl 2. This was just a solid job of building a rivalry over a few months and creating a story. You can see from the match just fundamental stuff that you don't need promos nonstop. You don't need crazy mic work, just great technical wrestling, incredible high flying. It's something that the fans hadn't seen before. Tom, what do you got?
Yeah, look, as always, you gave us a great blow-by-blow of the build and how we got to the match. Just a few other notes to throw in there as we head into the payoff. The cruiserweights didn't start when Nitro started. There were guys putting on phenomenal light heavyweight matches during this era, and this is no different. So it's really cool to see these guys, and you look at it, and you're like, wait, 92? I didn't think those started until the Eddies and the Rays of the world came into WCW. So just really fun to think about. Pillman was awesome. It's someone that I remember even not watching a ton of WCW as a kid. I just remember really liking him. And so, you know, just the stuff he was doing during this era was great. It was really unfortunate that we weren't able to see his entire career play out. You know, whether it was this stuff and just the innovative stuff that he was doing, at least for US audiences, that was awesome. And then a few years later, he's doing like the work shoots and all that crazy stuff. I mean, the guy was just always money. He was always a real trailblazer. He was always doing new things. And everything he did was just awesome, even though we just didn't get a ton of it because of his career being cut short due to a variety of things. So here we go. For those of you that want to watch along, now's your opportunity. Log into the WWE Network and go to Super Brawl 2, which took place in 1992. Again, that's Super Brawl 2 in 1992. We're going to be at the 8-minute mark when you hear the bell ring. Again, that's 8 minutes on the nose. That's when we'll start. If you hit play when the bell rings, you'll be right on target with us. And you know, as always, if you can't watch along, you're riding to work, you're in the office, you're at the gym, wherever you might be, that's okay. But I can always go back and watch it later. So again, for those of you that want to watch Super Brawl 2, 1992, we're at the 8-minute mark. When you hear that bell ring on the other side of this, hit play. And with that being said, it's time for the payoff. All right, we're here with Flying Brian Jr. himself, and we're watching a classic, epic match. It's great to have you here and to be able to watch this masterpiece from your father along with you.
Oh, absolutely. This is the match that everybody comes up to my merch table and talks about. So,
yeah, at any point, feel free to let us know what's going on the screen or some of your favorite moments from this match. Obviously, you've seen it many times before, but since people love talking to you about it, I want to make sure that you're able to, you know, acknowledge some of the things going on in the ring. You know, what was fun watching this one back is Jim Ross and Jesse Venturi were doing commentary together, which is pretty awesome. So, hey, first thing I want to ask you, you just recently met Liger. Tell us about how that happened, what kind of conversation you had with him.
Well, it was absolutely phenomenal. You know, the Japanese are just so respectful in every single way. You know, very nice people. Huge shout out to Rocky Romero. He really was very helpful and accommodating to meet Liger and to talk to him and to sort of translate if there was any translating necessary. Just completely super nice dude. And so I got into the locker room going in there to meet Liger, and I brought him a framed photo. So like a photograph that was framed and had a picture of my dad catching him on a dive. So that was cool. I handed Liger the photo, and he was very thankful for the gift. And you know, it's Japanese custom to sort of bow and do that sort of thing and stuff like that. So I was ultimately just very, very happy to finally have that meeting. And he was very happy to see me, and he knew who I was. So it was really neat.
So do you think this is the best match of his career?
I don't know. See, my favorite one is the one with Mark Mero that everybody loves. But this is definitely what you want at this time when this is booked and for this type of title. This is the best match that could have been. Nobody else at this time was going to put on this match, right?
Well, and the thing too is, so this was 92. I think everyone thinks that once Nitro got started, that's when they signed all the cruiserweights and gave them all the opportunity and kicked off
but
shows.
But I'll tell you what, he might not have known this was going to be his best match looking back. You know what I mean? Like, at this point in his career, he might have been critical of himself, or he might have thought, oh, okay, well, that was awesome. I could have done this better, but I don't think he was going back to the locker room saying, oh, I just had the best match of my career, because nobody knows it at the time. Everything's in retrospect, right? Nobody gets their match star grade right when they walk through the curtain, right? So I think at this point in his career, he's trying to work at the highest level possible. And it just so happens that this is what people remember as one of his best matches. Because they're innovating too, right? So they're ahead of the times.
Well, and that's what I was getting at.
They don't know if they're too far ahead, or they don't know if the crowd's going to understand what they're doing.
Yeah, back in 92, all the old-timers were saying that these two were flipping like and flopping
right
too much.
I mean, that was phenomenal right there. Just that drop kick out of the ring. Like, you don't see guys do that today, which is a problem. Like I said, it was all about making things competitive and real. See how he gets right back in the ring. You know, there's no bullshit, right?
What I always love, because, you know, we watch these matches on mute, and so I always love watching the fan reactions. I mean, they're into it. They were on their feet. So
yeah, smooth, yeah.
Yeah,
there's the grounded abdominal stretch right there.
Do you do that?
I do sometimes, just because I like it.
No, it's just
nobody does it. Yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't do it if a bunch of people did it. Nobody does this move. Obviously, I took it from this match, but at the same time, I added my own thing to it. I'll slap people on the chest and I'll poke them in the eye and shit. But this is more of a competitive, technical match. There's no real like heel and baby face here.
Yeah.
I think my dad is, you look closely at his face, he's a little bit more serious. I guess he's trying to be the heel or the aggressor here.
So for some of the younger listeners, tell them about your father's football career, because he got quite a reputation as just being like just a feisty son of a bitch.
Like I said, my life is similar to my dad's in a way. He's a lot smaller here than he was. In football, he was a big, jacked son of a motherfucking gun. You know what I mean? Like, he was jacked up. So I'm thinking here, he's a lot leaner. He's a lot more flexible. He's a lot more of an aerial kind of flying Brian here. I want to say he weighs 208 pounds. But when he first got into wrestling in the Stampede, this dude was shoot 225, 228, I want to say. And just, he was a defensive lineman in football, so you couldn't be small at all. You actually needed, just so you could compete on a physics level, you had to have some amount of weight on you to throw around, right? So he was constantly eating and choking down rice and getting as big as possible for football, where he was competing on the defensive line. But when he went to the NFL, they wanted to move him to linebacker, which was more of a running position, more of a pass coverage position. But at the same time, you had to be big and fast. So he was already working really hard to get big, but getting big was slowing him down because it wasn't his natural size, right? So eventually the NFL's weight and speed and height outclassed him. But to think that he was a top 1%, because, you know, you're going to be in the top 1% of athletes to make it to the NFL, you know, to go from that to wrestling, he could afford to lose some size in wrestling and just focus on his pure athleticism, if that makes sense. So
tell us a little bit about your training. So you trained in Calgary, so did your father. How did you end up in Calgary, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, Calgary was more or less just a safe, good decision on my part starting out. It was one of those things where not only was I able to meet Bruce Hart and the whole Hart family when I was up there, but I was able to say that I trained at the safest and most comprehensive starting off school. And the way Lance does it is in a limited camp fashion. You know, you're not training with him for 6 months to a year. You're going up there for 3 months, you're getting a comprehensive rundown on the technical side of wrestling, the grappling, and also getting into the storytelling and then eventually the bigger high spots and stuff. So it was a very comprehensive school.
Did you see the old Hart House? Had they already sold it at that point? Was it long gone? Was it still there?
You know, I hate to be like, oh, I'm not a mark and all this shit, but I went up there to train and stuff, and they told me that the family that owned the Hart House was really tired of people coming up to that all the time. and they said they had cameras and stuff and they just had security. So I was like, you know what? Let's not go see this Hart House because I don't want to disrespect this country and these people that live here. So a couple of the kids wanted to go, but I was like, look, we're up here to train and stuff. I actually went to the house where my dad, where he lived with Bruce Hart at his house. So I'd rather have gone there and hung out with their family than gone there and pestered the strangers that lived in the new Hart house. You know, like,
yeah, and I'm assuming the new family doesn't have a, a wrestling ring on the outside of the house.
Like they weren't going to let me in and see. So I was like, there's no point. I mean, I could have drove by. It was just one of those things. I wanted to spend my time wisely while I was up there and I never got around to seeing it.
Yeah, my guess is they may have refinished the basement too. So here's what I want to ask you. Yeah, you go through training. You're now a quote-unquote independent wrestler. You're out there. You're getting your own bookings. Walk us through the entrepreneurial aspect of being an independent wrestler. What was some of the business schooling that you got in college? How was that helpful? And what's a week look like for you trying to get your name out there and trying to build your brand?
Well, it's funny you say that because obviously my college degree is very helpful, very impactful in what I'm trying to do here. You know, I mean, wrestling is one of those things that you are a business. Everything you do is a business, from buying your gear to buying your 8x10s to selling those to selling them online to paying the tolls when you travel, when you drive, you're paying for gas. You got depreciation on your vehicle. Do you need an accountant or are you smart enough to do all your accounting on your own? You know, how far can you get away with how much money and how much can you make your body worth based on the medical costs that are inevitable? How much is your body worth? The depreciation on your spine, things like that. How far can you go? How many years can you wrestle? All these are questions that every wrestler should be asking themselves every time they do anything, right? So it's like some people are in it for the fame and some people are in it for the money and some people are in it because they're passionate and they love wrestling. But the bottom line is if you don't treat yourself with the respect that you should a business, then you're not going to succeed in any of those things that you desire. So the best bet is to just have a good education of business to fall back on. I'm not saying I'm perfect. I don't think I generate perfect revenue and accounting as I could. You know, everybody has different things they focus on. And right now I'm still in that stage of building myself as a performer. So for me, getting my name out there is just having as many matches as possible and staying on the road. I personally try not to take bumps during the week, you know, when I don't have to. But when I'm on the weekends and I'm performing and I'm traveling all over the world, during the week I will focus more on yoga and weight training and going to the post office and sending out orders and stuff. But I try not to do any flat back bumps when I don't need to because, like I said, you have a certain card, you have a certain time limit that you're able to do this job for. And you're losing money every time you take a bump. So you got to think about that and try to get the most out of your career.
And what percentage of guys that at your level right now, okay, on the same scene, in the same circles you're in, what percentage of them are running it like a business the way you are?
It's hard to say because I think I've seen a statistic online that a very small percentage of people make a living wrestling. And then an even smaller percentage are what you would say, like making a good living. But I think that's one thing that's missing in a lot of guys today. I know guys that are leaps and bounds ahead of me in experience and talent in the ring, perhaps, but they aren't marketing themselves in a way that's going to be profitable for a promotion, for a wrestling promotion, or manageable. I mean, I've seen guys that are 100 times better wrestlers than me, but they don't have any nice gear, so nobody really cares who they are. And there's just so many aspects that go into this, and if you're not maximizing your value in every window and staying in shape as well. You know, a lot of guys, great wrestlers, they don't stay in shape. So everybody's missing a little bit of something. Like I said, I don't think I'm perfect. Still got only a few years in this business. So plenty of ring experience to work on. And I think in a couple more years, I think I'll be a pretty big star because just like I said, I'm trying to hit the nail on the head with everything. And you got to attack it from all sides. Lance Storm gave me the advice to start treating this like a job because as soon as you get started, people are going to expect you to be, you know, you're Brian Pillman Jr. and start treating it like it's a business and like it's a job, or else people are going to think you're just playing.
Well, that's exactly right. It may sound odd for some of our listeners, but I mean, the guys like you that are doing it the right way, you're building your brand and you are a brand and you've got to market it. You've got to interact with fans. So what's the biggest thing that you have to work on as a performer? What do you need to get better at?
There's always going to be the increasing scale of things. You know, right now, I can't say I can go and have a really good 30-minute match, you know? I can't say I can go out there and have an okay 45-minute match. So I think once you're having good, solid 15-minute matches, then you're having some really good 20, 25-minute matches, then you start adding on more cardio into your regimen. But then also you got to get booked that way too. Like, a lot of companies aren't booking anybody for over 20 minutes. So the trend these days is to have a lot shorter matches. So I'm at this point where I want to have bigger, longer matches to increase my cardio and ability in the ring.
So was there any hesitation to use the Pillman name? Did you think about just trying to create some separate gimmick?
Yeah, I've got like a million ideas for gimmicks because I'm a very highly creative person, but it was very, I don't want to say it was easy. I want to say it was the right thing to do. I think the right thing to do was to pay the respect to who I am and to my father, because he named me Brian for a reason. I think he always wanted me to be a wrestler. And I think it was part of his vision to make me the second junior version of him. But I don't want to be exactly like him, no. But when it comes down to it, my heart told me that my name was Brian Pillman, and I wanted to be Brian Pillman Jr. So that's exactly who I am. And my name isn't a gimmick. My name is on my driver's license because it's real. You know what I'm saying? So it's very important for me, not only just because it's who I am, but because it's my story in wrestling is that much more real. And anytime I have to cut a promo or I have to reference anything. See, for a lot of people, wrestling is fake. A lot of people have promos where they are saying a makeup character. You know, maybe they're a wizard or maybe they're a dinosaur or something. So they have to cut a promo in a way that isn't real. But when people book me as Brian Pillman Jr., when people are bringing me in and flying me all over the world, it's because I have a real story in wrestling that's not fake. So it enables me to deep down and dig down into a very emotional state and really showcase my story in this business. And that's a beautiful thing, I think. And it would have been a crime to the wrestling business if I had not expressed that with you guys and if I had done something completely out of the blue other than Brian Pillman Jr.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm old school, but I think it's cool as hell what you're doing. And I think you're striking that chord where you're paying tribute to him, but you're doing it your own way in a modernized version. And I think that that's fantastic. I love it. And again, if you're going around calling yourself Fred Johnson and giving yourself a wizard gimmick, I think people are just going to shit all over it. But here's a question related to that. And that was fantastic match, by the way.
This match is very modern. A lot of people wrestle this way today. Very back and forth, very little heat, very up and down, a lot of big moments, a lot of high spots.
It's a great match. So last question on this match, because we were talking about paying tribute to your father. If Triple H calls tomorrow and says, we want you at NXT, but we got to repackage you, are you going to do that? Or do you really want to stick with having his name throughout your career?
I think it depends on the circumstances and the situation. I think I'm definitely very capable of doing so. I think I have the creative range, and I think I'm talented enough to pull off anything that they throw my way. But at the same time, I got to look at it from the business perspective and where I'm at in my career. If I'm not ready to evolve, if I'm not ready to change, then I don't think so. If I am ready to be different, because that's something that might interest me. I may want to change my name at a certain time in my career. I may want to become a new version of Brian Pillman Jr. that maybe goes under a different moniker. But at the same time, I don't want that to be on anyone else's terms, if that makes sense. They told me that was the plan. That was the only way I was getting in. Then I might wait a little bit and then wait till that the time is right for that, right? If I'm still learning and I'm still getting booked and a lot of these companies and cities and towns want to see Brian Pillman Jr., then that's experience that I can get under that brand. And those are matches that I can have that are only going to make me a better wrestler. And maybe by the time I do go to WWE or NXT, I'm already that much better than what they would have ever imagined had I came in the door day one as just a kid, no training or no matches. And then to give me a fake name, let's put it this way. You go to WWE, you got no experience, all this, and then they give you a fake name. Well, then now you're just stuck in limbo and you're basically whatever they want to do with you. But for me to go out here, get the experience, really meet all these fans who truly had a passion for wrestling and get to know me for me and really, like I said, travel the world and get the experience, then by the time they bring me in, it doesn't matter what name they want to give me because I'll be that good. I'll be able to work with it. You know what I mean? And then the fans will still know who I am at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. Well, you're doing it the right way. Because I mean, we've seen people, and we've had some of them on this show, that they were fantastic. The problem is they got called up when they were your age. They obviously weren't ready for it. And then, you know, the fans see through it. They're out of work. And so you're better off coming in as an established star at 28 than coming in green and it's just not working out. So I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I'm good for business to be booked and to be on all these shows. And I think it helps everybody to have me on the show and to have me as Brian Pillman Jr. because it is a story and it does generate buzz and it generates revenue for everybody. So the fans are happy. The boys in the back are happy. Everybody's happy. Like the moment at PWX in South Carolina when I met Jushin Thunder Liger, I mean, that was a very emotional night. A lot of guys went out there and left it all on the line and it was a big moment for me. So I might not have had that moment if I was Jakar Noir and Wizard Man, you know, so it's like, who knows?
Yeah. Well, hey, it was great watching this match with you and appreciate you watching this classic with us.
Hell yeah, man. I appreciate you having me on and definitely great to rewatch that match.
As always, I want to thank Brian Pillman Jr. for talking with us. We got a couple other matches lined up with him that we'll share on future episodes, but we don't want to waste any time. So Tom, what'd you think of this one?
Well, first of all, if we're watching a match from nearly 30 years ago and it holds up today, you got to give it credit. And when I say that, I'm really talking about the match because look, we're going to cover stuff on the payoff where the build was incredible and the crowd went crazy and there's some cool aftermath and it is big in historical terms, but you're going to watch the actual match and go, yeah, it was kind of boring or it was slow and prodding. And it's some of the matches we watch, the payoff's going to be great, but the match just isn't going to hold up in terms of moves that are happening in the ring. That being said, this one does. Okay, this match, you put it on a Monday night, you put it on a pay-per-view, you watch it with two current athletes, and you're going to think it was awesome. So this thing really, really holds up. Another thing, Jesse Ventura, JR on commentary, are you kidding me? I love them both. You put those together, they are money. And what I love about it, and Jeff, you're going to hear me say this over and over again on this podcast, I love when guys call it like a sport. You're watching it because you want to suspend belief. You want to be involved in the match. You want to get excited about what's happening. You want to really question, can they get to the ropes, right? So the more they can call it like a sport, the better. And that's what they did in this match. And Jesse always did it. I got to tell you, for my money, he's the most underrated commentator, certainly in my lifetime. And if you don't believe me and this match didn't convince you, go back, watch Hogan Andre at WrestleMania 3 if you want to see a clinic on how to be a heel color commentator. He is so good. Another little thing, I just dig the guardrails. The old school ones, there's no banner on them. You know, it's not the black ones that they use on WWE TV now. I just like the old school guardrails. And those bumps look awesome, especially when they drop their throat on them. I'm sure the black ones now that they use, it hurts, but it doesn't look like it. Again, not that it would knock the wind the hell out of us, but one of the best openers you'll ever see. I mean, it's just a hot opener. It's a great way to start a show. The double dropkick spot at the end was fantastic. Jesse selling it before and after of how should he have gone for the cover instead of going up the top rope. I love that stuff. I love the near falls at the end. I love near falls that you actually think might end the match, but weren't the guy's finisher, right? Now it's like in a big match, we see a finisher hit and we're like, nah, it's a little too early for that. He's going to kick out. And it's just those really false finishes meant something. And then ultimately, you know, we got a finish that came out of nowhere with a roll up, which was great. So just fantastic. Jeff, what'd you think of the match?
Yeah, I'll first say that this was, like you said, it just classic commentary, especially from JR. There's a reason we advertise his show and advertise on his show and support him. And we love the guy because just across all sports, there's the great play-by-play announcers and the ones we love. None can do what JR does. I just found myself totally engrossed when I was hearing him. I was actually typing up my notes for the show and just noticed how into the match he was, and it got me excited. So even like I took a second and like I've watched it a bunch now, but I caught myself too. And that's how it should be. And so I highly recommend if you haven't watched the match just on its own, do that because it's worth it. And so I thought about 4 or 5 minutes in when Liger faked the dive to the outside and then handstand backflipped into the center of the ring off the ropes, and the crowd just lost it. He started pumping them up, you know, fist pumping, like they were so excited for him to do that. And I feel like that move, we see it a lot now, especially like someone like Ricochet or someone like that. But back then, U.S. audiences, a lot of that, both guys, just hadn't seen stuff like that. And it was just cool. And then about 9-10 minutes in, I really enjoyed the slaps during the figure four leg lock. I usually associate that with Flair because, of course, the figure four. But I just enjoyed that entire exchange of the figure four, the crowd into it, losing their mind, the slaps, the chants, just great all-around wrestling. And I'm with you, Tom. It's that old wrestling saying, if you don't go on last, go first. And these guys really put on a clinic.
Yeah, I mean, it was just an absolute killer of an opener. So walk everyone through the aftermath. What took place following this match? What was the fallout to it? That's what we like to do here, is give you a really good aftermath of what took place.
Yeah, so briefly, Jushin Thunder Liger is still wrestling. He was just recently at the early July, was in the G1 Climax. And so he's still out there doing what he does and his kind of long-term aftermath. More recent, right after the match, they did go their separate ways and kind of start new feuds and all that, but Flying Brian was actually the longest reigning WCW light heavyweight champion. The strap wasn't around for very long. It only lasted about a year, but he really had continued success after that, and then really hit a stride in 1993, little known tag team, the Hollywood Blondes, with a up-and-comer wrestler who we've spoke about a little bit earlier, the one and only Stunning Steve Austin.
What?
Blonde hair. I know the photos are out there. He wasn't always the bald-headed, beer-drinking Steve Austin that we know and love in the Glass Shatter, but they would actually go on to win the NWA World Tag Team Championship. And then Pillman, after all this, eventually ended up in ECW, in WWF, but that story's for another day. So the Wrestling Observer newsletter said, quote, "The decision to start the show off with a bang with Liger Pillman sounded smart on paper because they wanted to do a blow-away show, and it's best to start with a guaranteed blow-away match. However, this was such a blowaway match that it really wasn't until 5 matches later that the crowd fully got into a match," end quote. And so it was given 4.75 stars and easily won the best match of the night with over 85% of those who responded. So,
and Jeff, it sounds ridiculous to say that, hey, it killed the crowd for multiple matches, but you and I have both been at shows where we've seen just a ridiculous, off-the-charts, incredible match. And then just subconsciously, you're just drained. You're sitting there and you're like, you know, man, it might take me a few matches or something big to get back up and excited again. It's real. It happens. And their intentions were right, but I can understand where people are just so burned out from this match that it really took them a while to get back into the show again.
Yeah, and then a few years later, these two actually did meet again in the ring at the first ever WCW Nitro. And it was the first match, first Nitro, all of that, and that was September 4th, 1995. So that's pretty cool, actually, that they've got that distinction. So it was a quick match. It was just a 6-minute opener, again, opening. So certainly, it wasn't the classic, but still just a little bit of interesting trivia there, and great that these two got another chance to lock up again. So now I would say, how about we do our payoff scores? Tom, I believe, or I set the high bar last week. What do you got for this week?
All right. So just to remind everyone how we do things at the payoff, we don't rank the match just based on in-ring quality or the maneuvers that took place, right? We look at a whole bunch of factors, and it's up to us. Sometimes the factors change, but you know, we look at the build to the match. We look at the crowd. We look at the commentary. We look at how it falls into other things that were going on at the time, any historical context to it. Really, whatever we feel is important to the overall drama, not just the maneuvers two guys are doing in the ring. So there's no specific formula. I have my things I look for. Jeff has his. I guess depending on the mood we're in, maybe they change week to week, but it's our show. So Jeff and I don't discuss this prior. So he doesn't know what I'm going to say. I don't know what he's going to say. It could go anywhere. Jeff, for this one, I'm going to give it an 8. The pluses for me are obvious, right? It was a great match. It was ahead of its time. You had a hot crowd. It's a damn good opening match. The commentary was fantastic. The innovative stuff they did, it still holds up today, which says something considering this was 1992. There was a strong finish that came out of nowhere, which I really enjoyed. The only knock that I really have is there wasn't a major build or a storyline reason for this match taking place. Just two guys kind of ping-ponging a belt, okay? And neither guy was really hated. There wasn't really that heel face dynamic. I think the fans just kind of dug and respected both guys because they were just doing such cool stuff in the ring that many in the U.S. had never seen before. I think about some of the really cool storylines that WCW did with the cruiserweights probably a few years after this match. If they had attached one of those to this build, to me, it might have pushed me even higher. So that being said, the payoff was fantastic. I love this match. I'm going with an 8. Now, Jeff, let's see. Last week you gave a 10. So are you just going to keep giving out 10s or do you have a different score for this match?
Yeah, I'm going to mix it up this week. I will say, you know, when I'm thinking about a score, I don't look at this as one match is greater than another or less than another. And it's like one set bar that I have to look at. I'm sure that will drive some people crazy. I love consistency too, but I'm going to go with a 9 on this one. And I originally had an 8.5, but then I have to give it the extra half a point because of JR actually. And so I couldn't help but enjoy what he brought to the match. And so that extra little half a point, but then the in-ring work itself was just really mesmerizing to kind of see what they were doing and what they were accomplishing. And so I tried to put myself in the position of seeing what, like, people were seeing this stuff for the first time, a lot of them. And so I tried to put myself in that position and kind of what were people thinking. And it's rare nowadays, especially, you know, in wrestling, we think, wow, like, that's something new. Or, you know, if I'm sending messages to my buddies during the show of like, oof, we don't see that all the time. Like, you know, that type of stuff, you don't see it all that often anymore. And so not just in look and sound, but kind of like how people move in the ring or the different matchups we get to be in that position and see something like that fresh for the first time, it's incredible. And so if you really put yourself in that mindset, you can really look at the match differently. And at the end of the day, as my brother and I like to say, I was sports entertained. Absolutely. So Tom, home stretch, any thoughts?
My thought is 9. And so now every JR called match, you're going to give a 0.5 bonus to? Man, you got one hell of a way to come up with your number.
He liked one of my tweets one day. So for right now, I'm riding high on JR. So thanks, buddy.
So first of all, I want to say thank you again to Flying Brian Pillman Jr. Man, he was just a fantastic guest. And I feel like I'm saying this every week, but every guest has been fantastic. I don't know what to say. Just their insight, their perspectives, how generous they've been to be here, answering all the tough questions, watching whatever match we tell them we want to watch. We've been really lucky. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that go into this show and Jeff and I have to show up and work hard. All of you have to listen, but we also have to have a guest that's engaged and excited to be there. And all of our guests so far have been phenomenal. And man, we cannot wait to share with you everything we have coming up. So back to Brian Pillman Jr., as you heard during the match, he's doing all the right things to become a major star in the wrestling business. He's training with the right people. He's working on becoming well-rounded as a performer. He's getting advice from legends in the business. He's investing financially in himself. And I think most importantly, he just wants it. It's just someone that wants to really kick ass in this industry, and you can't teach that. So I can't wait for him to continue to get on bigger stages in the business. I certainly look forward to having him on the show again to talk about his father's legendary career. But you know what, Jeff? I'm just going to say it. I think one day he's going to be on the payoff, and he's going to be discussing one of his WrestleMania matches. I am that confident in his trajectory as a professional wrestler. So, Jeff, I'm calling for the finish here. Why don't you wrap up this week's episode for us?
Yeah, again, just thanks to Brian Pillman Jr. You can find him on Twitter. He's at Flying Brian Jr. And funny enough, at the time that we're recording this, he actually has a pinned photo of him. And if you couldn't believe it, Jushin Thunder Liger. So check that out and make sure to give him a follow. Again, it's Flying Brian Jr. JR on Twitter. So thanks for joining us again. Don't forget, as always, we post a teaser on social media every Sunday. And then we make sure that Monday, new episode of The Payoff. So if you like what you're hearing and you want more, as always, subscribe, give us those 5 stars, tell your friends, family, everyone, and make sure to like and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Where at, Tom?
At Payoff Pod. That's right. At Payoff Pod. Love to see you on there.
You got it. And so thank you for joining us once again, everyone, on The Payoff.